To the tribes, the agreement allows the five tribes to collaborate on wildlife management within their reservations and enhance their ability to manage natural resources in a sustainable manner. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 18th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff and Mark Moran. The producer's Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. That's coming up next.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. U.S.-China relations, two steps forward, one step back. Three West African coup regimes form a bloc, and Israel and Hamas inch closer to an agreement, but Netanyahu drops a bomb. First, U.S.-China relations, two steps forward, one step back. One step forward occurred in a Shanghai hotel room, where former U.S. and Chinese officials and others attending in an unofficial capacity engaged for the first time in 5 years in so-called Track 2 talks on nuclear weapons. The U.S. delegates expressed particular concern about China's possible use of a nuclear weapon if an attack on Taiwan were to go badly. The Chinese delegates said no. China was confident of success using conventional weapons. The talks are occurring at a time when China's nuclear arsenal has gone from about 300 in 2018 to around 500 today. Even though Track 1 talks between senior government officials on nuclear weapons are not taking place, these Track 2 talks are the next best alternative. Also on the mostly positive side, efforts to control China's fentanyl trade have made limited progress. We are seeing some meaningful steps, a senior Biden administration official said. There's a lot more to do, but we are encouraged, particularly by the actions of the last couple of weeks. He was referring to some arrests and the shutdown of some chemical manufacturers in China. Still, other reports suggest that there appear to be too many small firms in the business and too attractive a profit margin to make great progress in bringing these factories under control. One such report asserts that the chemical trade is back to where it had been when Biden and Xi Jinping met to discuss the matter for the first time last November. On the negative side are comments by the U.S. Ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns. He said that on numerous occasions, the Chinese authorities have intimidated citizens who wanted to attend U.S. embassy functions, such as talks on culture and healthcare. They say they're in favor of reconnecting our two populations, but they're taking dramatic steps to make it impossible, Burns told the Wall Street Journal. What they tell us and what they tell the world is they want people-to-people engagement, and yet this is not just episodic. This is routine. This is nearly every public event, he said. But Burns acknowledged that Chinese students seeking to enter the U.S. for study are being restricted. The reality is much worse than that. As an article for University World News points out, the detention, interrogation, and deportation of Chinese students and researchers, especially those with scientific interests, by U.S. immigration authorities is all too common. China has raised objections and demanded explanations, but it has failed to obtain a clear statement of U.S. policy. What may actually be involved is that most of these students and researchers specialize in information sciences that could have military applications. And most also are said to have ties to one of several Chinese universities with links to the military. This broad brush U.S. treatment in the name of national security thus mirrors China's paranoia about having its citizens attend American embassy functions. Three West African coup regimes form a bloc: Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. Three West African states led by the military following coups signed a confederation treaty recently, underscoring, in the words of Niger's leader, our common determined will to reclaim our national sovereignty. That means severing military and diplomatic ties to the West and rejecting association with ECOWAS, the 15-member Economic Community of West African States. ECOWAS, which held a summit meeting just after the three military leaders announced their association, had hoped they would reconsider their position. In a communique issued after the summit, the three countries' leaders said they had agreed to coordinate diplomatic actions, create a joint investment bank and stabilization fund, and pool their resources to set up projects in strategic sectors, including mining, energy, and agriculture. They are also expected to coordinate anti-terrorism operations against Islamic militants. Left unsaid is how their announced aim to end reliance on foreign powers squares with their invitations to Russian military advisors to train and equip their armies in place of French and U.S. advisors. Also unclear is how these extremely poor economies will replace the substantial funds earned from trade and aid with the ECOWAS countries. Israel and Hamas inch closer to an agreement, but Netanyahu drops a bomb. As reported by the Times of Israel, Hamas has given initial approval for a U.S.-backed proposal for a phased truce and hostage exchange deal in Gaza, dropping a key demand that Israel give an upfront commitment for a permanent ceasefire and end to the war. At the same time, a key stumbling block appeared to be Hamas's desire for written guarantees from mediators that Israel will continue to negotiate a permanent ceasefire deal once the first phase of a ceasefire goes into effect. The Hamas representative told the Associated Press the group's approval came after it received verbal commitments and guarantees, that's quote, from mediators that the war won't be resumed and that negotiations will continue until a permanent ceasefire is reached. Israel has sought to keep the wording on the transition between phase one and two of the deal vague enough to allow it to resume fighting against Hamas in Gaza if it chooses, while Hamas has sought to ensure that Israel will not be able to resume fighting once the sides agree to the initial six-week phase of the deal. Then on July 8th, Prime Minister Netanyahu may have lowered the boom on any deal. Just as Israel negotiators were returning to the negotiations, he issued four non-negotiable points. They are, quote, one, any deal will allow Israel to return to fighting until its war aims are achieved. Two, weapons smuggling to Hamas from the Gaza-Egypt border will not be possible. Three, the return of thousands of armed terrorists to the northern Gaza Strip will not be possible. And four, Israel will maximize the number of living hostages who will be returned from Hamas captivity, unquote. The Times of Israel said of these 4 points, quote, Netanyahu's statement at a crucial phase ahead of the resumption of talks sparked anger, both in Israel and among mediators, with some accusing him of attempting to sabotage hard-won progress. The latest act of sabotage is Israel's order to Palestinians to leave Gaza City in the north as a major attack is being launched. In other news, Iran elects a president. In something of a surprise outcome, a 69-year-old cardiologist has defeated a hardline ultra-conservative in a runoff election for the presidency. In the initial round, reformist lawmaker Masoud Pezeshkian won but failed to gain 50% of the vote over the former nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili. The election was to replace the hardliner Ebrahim Raisi, who was killed in a helicopter crash. The turnout in the first round was only 40%, the lowest since the 1979 revolution, and in the runoff round, turnout only rose to 50%. Some commentators interpreted the low turnout as a rebuke of the regime, and so it seems. Younger Iranians took to the internet to urge peers to sit out the election, and it worked. The notion of reformist can be misleading in Iran's case. Pezeshkian will have to answer to the Ayatollah Khamenei, constraining the new president's reported desire to moderate social policies, such as crackdowns on women who don't wear the hijab, and foreign policies, which may include an effort to revitalize the nuclear agreement with the U.S. and others in order to reverse sanctions that have hurt Iran's economy. Publicly, the Ayatollah declared victory for Iran in the election, saying, quote, "Once again, the great will of the Iranians was manifested and embarrassed the enemies of the revolution, the system, and the Islamic homeland, and especially the evil efforts and planning of the Western Zionist media empire." The Shanghai Cooperation Organization concludes its latest summit. The 10-member Shanghai Cooperation Organization concluded its annual meetings in Astana, Kazakhstan, with a variety of pledges for closer cooperation. Xi Jinping gave an address that showed how this organization's work jibes with China's foreign policy goals: non-interference by any country in another's internal affairs, promotion of state security, and affirmation of the right to develop, including elimination of supply chain problems and sanctions. That last point received particular attention. Xi Jinping said in his speech, quote, "Facing the real risks of small yards and high walls," referring to U.S. policy limiting technology exports to China, "we must safeguard the right to development, adhere to universal inclusiveness, jointly promote scientific and technological innovation, maintain stable and unimpeded flow of industrial and supply chains, stimulate the endogenous driving force of the regional economy, and promote the realization of common development goals." NATO meets in Washington and plans for Ukraine. The just-concluded NATO summit meeting in Washington did much to shore up support of Ukraine, including Trump-proofing it, that is, preventing another Trump administration from undermining support of Ukraine's defense. Ivo Dalder, who served as U.S. ambassador to NATO during the Obama administration, said the new measures constituted, quote, "a significant step forward in that the alliance would take on more responsibility for training and arming Ukraine's military. It does bring Ukraine and NATO closer together on the practical and operational sense," Dalder said. "What it doesn't do is solve the strategic issue, which is, when will Ukraine become a member of NATO?" The final communique calls Ukraine's path to membership irreversible. "As Ukraine continues its vital reforms, we'll continue to support them on an irreversible path to NATO membership," said outgoing NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. "The work we're doing together now will ensure that when the time is right, Ukraine can join without delay. Not a question of if, but when," he said. But in fact, few NATO members support the idea. "As usual, the demand is for Ukraine first to clean up its house on corruption and other elements of undemocratic governance. How it's supposed to do that in the midst of a war is never addressed." Interestingly, Russia's defense minister placed a call to U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin right after the summit, only the second such call in over a year. Contents of the call were not revealed, but we may presume that Russia was expressing concern over pledges by several NATO members, including Britain, to allow Ukraine to use its weapons for strikes deep inside Russia. The NATO ministers also addressed China's military support of Russia in terms never used before. China, said the NATO declaration, quote, "cannot enable the largest war in Europe in recent history without this negatively impacting its interests and reputation." China is not supplying Russia with finished weapons, but it is supplying computer chips, software, and other technology that Russia is using in its defense industry plants. China's foreign minister Wang Yi replied angrily, saying, quote, "NATO should stick to its duty, not put its hands into Asian affairs, not interfere with China's internal affairs, and not challenge China's legitimate interests. China wishes to sustain engagement with NATO on the basis of equality, and develop contact on the basis of mutual respect, unquote. Now the question is, will NATO's warning to China mean sanctions, such as the U.S. has imposed on Chinese suppliers to Russia? Finally, the African National Congress in South Africa must govern in coalition. The ANC's failure for the first time ever to win a majority in recent national elections has forced it to govern by coalition, a government of national unity. Cyril Ramaphosa was re-elected president as a result, but controversy and infighting have hardly subsided. That's because the ANC's coalition partner is its biggest opponent, the Democratic Alliance, a choice that drew astonishment from the liberal left. A white-led unholy alliance, former President Jacob Zuma called it. The Democratic Alliance mainly represents white and wealthy suburbia, pleasing foreign investors and the South African stock market. Racial differences now dominate the scene, with Zuma's opposition saying Ramaphosa has made a Faustian deal to stay in power at the expense of black interests. A particular issue is landholding, whether or not the government may expropriate property without compensation in order to put land in the hands of landless blacks. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's hot out. You know it. I know it. As much as it's been recognized that the human-caused climate crisis is contributing to higher temperatures and heat waves, our built environment can do the same, especially in cities. It's called the urban heat island effect, which basically means that cities experience much warmer temperatures than nearby rural areas do. But just how much of an impact does this effect have, and how is it connected to the environment in different neighborhoods? Climate Central looked at this question in new research released on July 10th. Across the country, they looked at 65 major cities and estimated how much hotter it gets than baseline in different neighborhoods because of what residents have built there. Of the 50 million people included in the analysis, 68% lived in an area with an urban heat island index of 8 degrees or more. So when the forecast says it's going to be 80 degrees, people experience a temperature of 88 degrees in those neighborhoods. In Portland specifically, 60,000 people live in parts of the city that have a UHI index of 9 degrees or more. But what exactly are the factors that make different neighborhoods hotter? The first one is called albedo. Here's the MIT Concrete Sustainability Hub to explain.
If you've ever walked barefoot on pavement in the summer sun, you probably know how burning hot it can get. This phenomenon, as it turns out, is more than just a nuisance. It actually has a dramatic impact on our daily lives, from the Earth's climate to human health. We refer to it as albedo. Here's how it works. Solar radiation constantly enters the atmosphere, where it is either absorbed or reflected by the Earth's surface. While the energy that is absorbed stays and warms the Earth, the reflected energy travels back to the atmosphere, some of which is returned to space. Albedo is a measure of this reflected radiation. The higher the albedo, the more energy is reflected, and the lower the albedo, the more energy is absorbed. We can actually measure the magnitude of albedo, in large part due to color. Lighter colored surfaces reflect more radiation, which we perceive as light, and have a higher albedo. On the other hand, darker surfaces absorb more light and have a lower albedo. So what impact does albedo have on our lives? When sunlight hits a city, dark man-made surfaces on pavements and roofs absorb this energy and begin to heat up. This warms surrounding areas throughout the day and long after the sun sets.
There are two other factors that influenced the urban heat island index too, along with albedo. The percentage of green space makes a difference. Plants help cool the air through a process called evapotranspiration, and less vegetation means less cooling. If you've spent any hot summer days in the forest, you may have felt the difference. Plants can help reduce peak summer temperatures in cities between 2 and 9 degrees, one study found. The other big factor is population density. Lots of human activities create extra heat. Think transportation, industrial facilities, and cooling down buildings. So sun-absorbing surfaces like roads, less green space, and high population density contribute to higher temperatures in urban areas. It's worth noting that extreme heat is the deadliest weather-related hazard in the U.S., so tackling urban heat islands could really make a difference as our weather gets more extreme because of the climate crisis. To learn more about this research, I spoke with Jen Brady, Senior Data Analyst at Climate Central. Thank you for being here. So we're talking about your new analysis of urban heat islands. Talk me through this sort of the basic top line stuff here. What was it that you sought to measure in this work?
Right. Well, we focus on climate change, and a lot of times climate change is confused with urban heat islands and they're separate. And so we wanted to really kind of distinguish between the two. The fact that there's baseline temperatures going up everywhere, whether you're in a city or not in a city. But in the city, there's an additional risk because temperatures are warmer in the city, basically because of two really broad things, which are the built environment, buildings, streets, and population density. So all the heat we produce living every day. And so we wanted to put some measures on that so people could see what the estimated additional risk was for people in different cities, and maybe provide a guide for folks to know what neighborhoods and what areas of the city might be most at risk.
Talk me through a little bit of the methodology. How did you go about measuring this kind of thing?
Yeah, ours is a little different. So a lot of people would have measured urban heat island, which is good because I think they all work together to kind of give us a more complete picture. Our method was a broader method, and we used a model value. And basically, the model builds in the types of design in the city. Is it dense building structure? Is it skyscrapers? Is it parkland? And then it also builds in population density. And based on those values, researchers have estimated how much additional heat that will provide to an area. And so we were able to, there's been some great research done really plotting the whole country, the land cover of the whole country. And we were able to look at all these different cities and outside of cities as well and say, this is the land cover. And based on that, this is how much additional heat there will be in this area.
So, right, your analysis looked at 65 different U.S. cities.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the trends that you noticed around the country?
Well, the baseline temperature we found that really existed in all the cities was 8 degrees. So that's really where all the cities had at least some measurable part of their population that was living at an area that was 8 degrees warmer than it would be otherwise if it was not for the built environment around them. And so that was kind of the big one. Some people, some cities, the temperatures would go up to 10, 12 degrees, maybe even higher. But really, that 8, 9 degree spot was really the sweet spot across the West. And that's a lot of heat, really, because if you're talking about 80 degree temperatures, that could mean your day feels it's 89, 90 degrees. So that, I think, would be the main finding. And knowing that more and more people live in urban environments now, there's more and more people who are going to be at risk.
Well, and you also looked at Portland, Oregon, where I am speaking to you from.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you notice about the maps of Portland?
Well, Portland is, there seems to be two ways that cities have their heat distributed. They have either a kind of an urban core, and the heat is really focused in the urban core. You'll see that maybe in like Chicago, I think, is a good example of that. You'll see kind of this spot in the middle, and that's where the heat is. Cleveland has that too. And then other cities tend to be more West Coast cities, Southwest cities, and some cities in Florida. The heat is more dispersed, which seems to represent a different growth pattern in those cities, and that maybe there isn't just this one urban core where everyone lives, but there's different densities around the city and different growth patterns around the city. And that's what we saw more for Portland, was some hot spots kind of scattered around the Portland area.
Obviously, urban heat islands are a big issue, and we're talking now at the end of Portland's first big heat wave of the summer, where at least 6 people have died in connection to the heat wave, many of them actually in Southeast Portland. What does your research indicate to policymakers? Is that part of the conversation as well as how to act on this kind of information?
Well, our goal is to really get the information out to the communicators of the world to help tell the story of where this is happening and how this is happening. And then hopefully the policymakers or even community organizations or citizens will pick it up and say, okay, what can we do about this now that we've realized this is, it's not just our imagination. There's a real problem here, and there's a real issue that's making us feel hotter. I think it's easy for sometimes you say, oh, I'm just, you know, I just think I'm feeling hotter. But in these places, it truly is. And so hopefully then solutions can be targeted in a way to maybe the places that need it the most right now, and then rolled out more gradually into places that are maybe in a little better shape at this time.
You mentioned some of the things that you measured that are known to contribute to a higher urban heat island in this index, that having to do with the built environment, how much paving there is. What are some of the things that are maybe the opposite of that cut down on this extra heat spike?
Yeah, this is one interesting thing about this topic, is there are solutions, and there's solutions at different scales. Say a neighborhood that we have to take action, and we want to take action right now, and we can't wait for our city to take action. They might decide to put up something as simple as umbrellas along the street, or some sort of awnings along the street to cool the street where their residents are walking or sitting or standing at the bus stop, or trees. Trees is always a favorite, but trees sometimes take longer to grow. So that's kind of one of the problems with trees. You don't always get the shade immediately, but maybe you decide to plant some trees. Maybe you decide there's a big swath of pavement. Maybe it's something that was abandoned, and it would be cooler if you made that into a community garden, say. And these things, like I said, they could be in very small size, or they could be in a bigger size where a whole city makes an effort to identify these kind of neighborhoods and spots and make these bigger changes. And then there's engineering changes, which seems to be a lot of experimentation with now. You may have heard about their painting pavement lighter colors so it's more reflective in some cities. White roofs have been popular for a while to reflect, or green roofs to also reduce the amount of heat that absorbs. So those are obviously bigger engineering solutions that are probably going to need to be done by cities or building owners. But there's a whole range, which is a really nice thing about this problem being able to be solved.
I think that it is at a stage, especially for Portland right now, where, you know, we can look to other cities who have much more of a history with intense heat. We're not really used to it here. And, you know, our built environment doesn't reflect kind of the needs of how extremely hot it's been getting.
Right, and so many of them have traditionally been built to keep us warmer. And it's just a design choice. When you're thinking, oh, what do we need from this building? We need this building to keep us warm. And now, more and more months of the year, we really need to keep cool. Another advantage that places like Portland and Seattle have, that where the heat is really emerging, and if some of the systems are going into places, they can do it the right way and the best way. You know, sometimes you walk through older cities on the East Coast, there's a lot of window units that spew a lot of heat out the back of them. You know, maybe when buildings go up, or when air conditioning now is installed in buildings in the Northwest where it wasn't before, it can be done in a more efficient way, a cleaner way, a way that's not going to distribute waste heat, but a way that's also going to use the grid more efficiently and use less carbon, which is just adds to the vicious cycle of this. So there's an opportunity there for your area to kind of build into a hot zone in a better way.
Another thing that's mentioned in your research is how this urban heat is unequally distributed, and how that lines up in some ways with the history of racial redlining. Can you touch on that issue a little bit?
I won't go too in depth, because that was conducted by our friends at Columbia University, and they were kind enough to let us kind of have that study with ours so we could give people that additional resource. And what they looked at was cities all around the country, and looked at where were the historically redlined districts, and they found in those areas that temperatures tended to be hotter than in the areas that were not historically redlined. And, you know, varies from city to city, but it was a pattern overall across the country. So again, that may help people if they want to go in. And like you said, you know, Portland is kind of at the beginning of this thought about, you know, what are we going to do when it gets really hot? Maybe that'll help you say, these are the neighborhoods that are probably most at risk, and we should target them in our efforts.
You've touched on this a little bit, but how do you feel that your analysis with Climate Central fits into other urban heat island research? Where is it in that conversation?
Yeah, ours is kind of a broader scope. A lot of people, what they'll do is they'll go out on like a few days of the year and take temperatures. So that's very helpful to give you kind of an actual temperature on this block or this neighborhood. Like I said, other people have looked at heat in particular neighborhoods that maybe are lower income or traditionally with discriminated populations. So I'm hoping that ours is just kind of another piece. We're able to take a broader look too, because you don't need as many resources to go into 65 cities if you are doing a more modeled approach. So we're hoping also we can maybe provide some cities that don't have the resources to do the really in-depth analysis, some starting points to think about. So hopefully it kind of is part of the bigger picture. And with all these things, we're going to start to really be able to focus in on what the problem is.
And off of your analysis, are there more questions to be answered? Like where might research go after this?
Oh, I think, yeah, there's definitely always more questions to be answered. Probably the big one is to continue to look at the demographics and how different populations are affected, whether that be age or race. So that's another one that always needs more analysis. And then I think we need to start looking at how the solutions are working, because people are putting solutions into place. So it'll be interesting to see if people can start measuring, you know, this neighborhood maybe we looked at 10 years ago, didn't have any parks, didn't have any green space. Now it does. How much cooler is it in that neighborhood? Really like to see the success of some of those solutions being documented.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't touch on?
I guess the only thing just to say is that because the built environment is and population is the culprit, you can also find some hotspots outside of cities. They aren't as intense, but wherever you have intense development without cooling factors like trees or parks, you're going to have hotter spots. And so I think, you know, that's the other thing that we kind of liked about this, is we're able to kind of show that there's hotspots outside of cities too, and we need to be conscious of that.